You can just be doing all the right things all day long, and then come 9 o'clock at night, you just get this overwhelming desire to eat.
Do you want to escape the feeling you have now?
My relationship with food, I had way more in common with people in Narcotics Anonymous than I did in Weight Watchers. I did not have a how I looked problem that I wasn't managing to sort out. I had a food problem, hold it lightly mentality, which applies to behavioural change. That's what works. And the other thing that works...
Hello and welcome to Own Your Health with me, Katie Brindle. And today, beautiful, amazing fellow West Londoner, Sharu, who has come here today to talk about all sorts of interesting things. We're not scripting this, but if you want to listen or watch us on Spotify, you can listen to us on Apple, you can watch us on YouTube, we're all over socials. Basically, there's no excuse. So, Sharu, I am going to invite you in to talk today because I feel like we're in a marching band together. We are talking the same talk, we are walking the same walk, we've got a slightly different drum, but it's the same. And I want to talk to you about healing with kindness because that's super relevant. I want to talk to you about how you lost 8 stone without going on a diet. I love your message that diets don't work, and also your incredible for working within prisons and dealing with inmates and how that related to a non-prison audience at the same time. So there's a lot to talk about. First of all, do you want to just tell everyone your story?
I am a psychologist and a coach, and I write books about behavioural change. So my background was working in the NHS. I was sort of trained as an assistant psychologist. And my first placement that I got was in substance misuse.
Right.
And so I started learning about how addiction is treated in the UK. And it was interesting because I was there at a time where more research was coming out and there was a real push towards going from this like hardline, rock bottom, people will change when they hate themselves enough, towards a more compassion-based, asset-based, acknowledge of people's ambivalence, acknowledge of the fact that there's reasons to stay the same way, and that actually it was compassion and support and the removal of shame and things like that that were helping people to actually not just activate behaviours but sustain behaviours long-term.
Now, this shame is something... Because you talk about shame and we're going to talk about kindness. So we're really sitting in the emotional plane dealing with the physical situation, which resonates amazingly with Chinese medicine because we understand that emotions and physical symptoms are completely interconnected.
Yeah. And I think, do you know, it's interesting because that's not a controversial thing.
No.
Like, and I think...
But it's not widely known.
Well, yes, but I agree, which is extraordinary, but... I think it's interesting what you were saying earlier about us coming at it the same way.
Yeah.
So, for example, when people talk about thoughts and feelings and behaviours and talk about cognitive behavioural therapy and stuff, and sometimes when it's hard to get over to people, you know, that your thoughts will change your feelings, they will change your nervous system immediately. There were examples that they used to use when I was being trained, like, imagine if you knew that someone was coming home that night and you were in bed and someone opened the door. And imagine if you didn't expect someone to be coming home that night and someone opened the door.
Yeah.
It's only the story that's changed how you feel and immediately changed your physiology.
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes, much like what you were saying earlier, a lot of this stuff, it isn't that it's contentious or controversial. It's that I think people don't have a route to it that they can relate to. And so, yes, I think it's very much that we're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think that anyone who doesn't think that that's the case just needs it reworded.
Yeah, in a way that makes sense to them in whichever form that is. So let's go back. So we're talking about shame and we're talking about addictive behaviour.
Yeah.
And then you bridge that gap from addictive behaviour within patients within the NHS, dealing with addictions, presumably to substances.
Yeah.
So not food at this stage.
No, there it was heroin and crack.
Wow.
And alcohol. And there was a lot of change resistance. And we weren't talking about food because in the same sense that we weren't talking about moderating alcohol or heroin. You know, this was on the sharp end of people are losing their children, people are losing their homes, their teeth, everything is going. And so they don't want to be using. And the reason that I, at that time, started relating to these people is because I felt powerless around food. And yes, I was gaining weight at speed and going on diets and, you know, I was professional at losing weight, which tends to mean that you're, you know, proficient in losing weight tends to mean you're proficient in gaining it.
Putting it back on again. And is that the yo-yo diet?
Yeah.
Kind of, I mean, anyone that's listening to this knows my story too. I'd always had a weight issue. I mean, I was on a diet from 3 years old. I just remember my entire childhood. My mother, who was very slim, had me on diets because I was apparently heavy. Now I look back at photos, I think, no, I wasn't. But by the standards of the 1970s, I was. And because the 70s then led to the 80s, which is now Kate Moss and the supermodels and everyone else, no offence to Kate Moss, because, you know, she is who she is. But, you know, when you're walking around Miss Selfridge or Topshop and that's the model and the beauty standard of the time, you're sort of looking at what was a size 10 body, I hasten to add, you're said to be overweight. And then ultimately, by the end of my twin pregnancy, I was clinically obese, and I know you've talked about this as well. So I was certified obese at 20 stone. And when the babies came out, I was 17 stone. And there was quite a lot of work to be done, not doing the whole yo-yo dieting, because it's so tempting, because there's so much about it.
Did you find that, did you know you were on a diet?
When I was a child?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, this is great. let me make
really
this all
curious.
About myself.
No, please, I'm really
Yeah,
curious.
No, it is a really interesting story because it's part of my narrative. But it's funny, you know, as you go into sort of healthcare, because we present ourselves as what we did and we sit here on podcasts and go, yes, I'm Katie and I did this and I did that and then I had this car accident and da-da-da-da-da, and you say it and it comes, it just becomes this story, which is kind of, well, this is who I am. And it's kind of, actually, I just have this overwhelming memory of the whole of my childhood not being allowed to eat. I wasn't allowed anything that everyone else was having. So it was just constantly, you couldn't have it. It's like, no, not for you. That is, I understand why my mother did it. But on the other hand, there was no understanding as to why I wanted it in the first place. And therein lies, isn't it? Like, can you feel the energy go?
I just want to know. I have a million questions to ask you.
Help me.
I want to ask you something. No, because there's so many things that only some people can relate to. So I'm trying to understand the point at which we discover that how we look. Because even Kate Moss, I believe the quote was, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels.
Yes.
Not even skinny looks.
Yeah.
Which would have been the real, that would have really landed in the problematic that we have. Because
yeah.
As a child.
And this is no offence to Kate Moss, by the way.
No, like, of course not.
Good for her. But there's an ongoing effect from the fashion industry on pretty much every single woman that doesn't look like that,
I'd
say.
She's more of a victim of it than, you know, will have been more of a victim of it than all of us. I mean, look at Jane Fonda. I mentioned Jane Fonda on a podcast recently and I was like, let's let it be known. She's one of my favourite humans to ever live.
Yeah.
But that video,
that
VHS of Jane Fonda was a normalised thing for people to do to lose weight before. I mean, I saw that.
Oh, yeah, the Jane Fonda workout. I was doing it for years.
I didn't know exercise was for anything else.
No, other than to lose weight.
No. I didn't know that was, you know, to move on purpose was for anything other than to move oneself from A to B or to stop being looking so fat.
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested with yourself. What was the point at which you might have thought, I look a certain way, which is why I have to eat differently? Because we think they're linked, you know, inextricably linked. It's quite an abstract concept.
Well, it's also incorrect.
Well, quite.
I mean, aside from the fact it's wrong, and it's interesting talking to this audience because the majority of this audience is 45 plus. And I also have teenage children, two of whom are daughters, one daughter's 22 now. But it's interesting looking at how that whole conversation has moved so much since when we were little. I mean, basically, when I was a teenager in the 80s, exercise was for weight loss, for sure. It wasn't for health, and health didn't exist. You were just thin. Mm-hmm. Thin was healthy, thin was beautiful. And you had to, and actually it wasn't healthy in my case because it led to a vast amount of yo-yo dieting and not understanding that, e.g., foods that create inflammation in the body were actually what was inflaming me. And having gone deeper into Chinese medicine, understanding that I have a big spleen energy, which actually is interesting when we're talking about shame, because shame is an energy frequency that hits the spleen. And the spleen is the organ in Chinese medicine responsible for the digestive system and gaining, not necessarily weight per se, because that's an oversimplification of the situation, but for us it's dampness. And dampness is that sort of expansive feeling when you feel sort of heavy and sluggish and lethargic, which kind of tends to accumulate in fat cells. And actually what it is my body's specific way, because of the composition of how I am and who I am, rather than toxins and the wrong things coming into my system, whether that was food or emotions, which is what we're talking about with shame and my mother making me feel, sorry, God rest her soul, but she was just like, you know, she just didn't want an overweight child because it wasn't fashionable. And the shame actually makes it worse because that makes you feel even heavier. And all of the information was completely incorrect. Now I know all the stuff I know. I rectified the whole situation, I think, in a similar journey to you, where I started to feel the joy of being alive and started to create around myself the expression of who I am, which naturally regulated my system. And by doing so, I regulated. And now I eat what I like. I never, ever sit there and go, I'm only going to have the fish and vegetable and green veg, or I'm not having a glass of wine, or I will go to the menu now and just eat what I feel like.
I it sounds condescending, but wildly applaud you, because very few people know how hard that is. One of my clients told me recently it's harder to lose 10 kilos than 50. And I kind of
know
what she means.
She does. Yeah. The last 10, okay.
Like, she's so right. It's so extraordinary.
When I was 17 stone post-birth, and by the way, had not kept anything in my system whatsoever, so how I got to 20 stone is still a scientific kind of anomaly, because if you're not actually eating anything or keep food in your system, how did that happen? Well, of course, it was fluid and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But when I came out of there diagnosed clinically obese at 17 stone, I, one way or the other, managed to get myself down to sort of 11 and a half. But my weight now is like 9, 9 and a half, which I easily maintain. I mean, easily, by doing all the right things that I enjoy doing. So it's mm-hmm. okay. But that last sort of the journey from 9 and a half to 11 and a half, I must have gained and lost those 2 stone about 20 times over the years, until I worked out how I balance my body mm-hmm. and live in harmony with myself. And then, of course, it becomes this effortless thing, which is amazing. And you've done the same.
Well, I think you're further ahead for because the weight loss thing itself, for me, I'm only now learning about my nervous system.
Right.
The angle that I came at it with, like, for example, I just told you as I came in, I haven't had coffee in 5 days. You know, I'm doing more somatic work, things like that.
Yeah.
But the angle that I came in at, again, ultimately to get the same outcome, is to say, what sorts of things do I need to do in order to make decisions that I'll be proud of tomorrow? In order to make decisions slowly, intentionally, because I'm very impulsive, addiction vulnerable, all of those things that make it so that I can really spiral and catastrophize. And so in the same way that you will have done a much more scientific and in-depth, as we know, deep dive into your body, I really focused on what my hands were doing. Mm. I was really out of hand. Not to, you know.
Oh, my God, I love it.
I really had to, like, get a grip on that. And so now I'm learning about health. Mm. And I think for so long I was doing such unhealthy things I had to unlearn, that to learn health, and then to learn to want to take care of my body, having spent a lifetime abusing it.
Which so many of us do.
Yeah, and also, it doesn't come out for free either. I mean, you lose that much weight over and over and over again. Aside from the aesthetic element of it, you know, of loose skin and blah, 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 which is unavoidable. You're also, my metabolism is not my friend, you know. Mm. Like, it doesn't help anything in the long term. And so that phase is one that I'm in now. But I know that, you know, the vast majority of people I speak to would be almost haven't gone as far as you have in terms of truly wanting to understand and know their bodies, because how they're behaving makes them feel possessed. So it feels like a leap. It feels like an ambitious leap. And so, for example, when I would be asked to sort of
feel
into my body. Yeah, you feel powerless. You're in addiction.
You're
in addiction.
Come so, 9 o'clock at night, like, you could, I've had this so many times in clinic with people, men and women, mainly women, but men and women, that you can just be doing all the right things all day long. And then come 9 o'clock at night, you just get this overwhelming desire to eat whatever it is. You then take it out of the house and then you end up eating dry crackers or dry cereal because something is overwhelming you and you just have to respond to it.
Yeah. You just have found a way to change how you feel quickly. I was having this conversation with one of my friends yesterday because he was talking about how the things like psychedelics and plant medicine becoming more mainstream has had a real impact, or he was telling me, on the recovery community of people who've been given these sort of loopholes that have messed with their sobriety, even though some of these interventions are being used as ways to help people to come off drugs and things. And so
there's a time and a place, though, isn't there?
I'm not sufficiently educated in the neurobiology, but I do know about behavior. And I know that when you have learned that you can change how you feel quickly, it's very compelling. Mm. And so when you've got used to not being able to change how you feel immediately, like when you have a glass of wine, you're like, oh, amazing. Mm. It takes a few sessions of meditation to be achieving that, you know, like that efficiency, let's face it.
Yeah.
And of course, the meditation is a gift that keeps giving, and the wine will become less effective with, you know, and you, the you know, the ROI on the wine is much lower. But nonetheless, for someone who has learned that they mustn't try to change how they feel quickly, it's really important to stay in that place where you know that you're best off doing things slowly, or else it's too compelling. And I certainly, I tell people this when they say to me, like, why am I eating this? I mean, you'll relate to this. Why am I eating this? I can't even taste it, right?
I don't even want it.
Possessed. I don't even want it, right? Mm. Why am I doing this? And often people will say, it doesn't even make me feel good.
Yeah.
And I will say, but it makes you feel differently. And when you don't feel well, you're not discerning, frankly. You know, you're not discerning and ambitious about the feeling you'd like to choose. You just want to escape the feeling you have now. So if you've learned over time that there are various things that you can do, now, of course, some people will exercise instead to change their physiology. My work isn't in whether exercise is objectively healthier than ultra-processed food. Although, I mean,
that'd be a bit of a waste of your talent to just sit there saying that.
One would hope that's implicit. But for the point of the point is that if someone needed to exercise every time someone annoyed them so they didn't do something they regretted, that would still be an impulse control issue.
Yes.
So from my perspective, if we take the judgment out of it, that's what I'm looking at.
Mm.
How long are you, and so in your work, from the research that I've done, what I understand is that you are preemptively putting in place things every day, all the time, practices that make it so that when you get to that point of making the decision, your nervous system is already ready to make choices from the wisest, most compassionate version of you that has your long-term goals in mind.
Mm.
I've learned that on the spot. So now I'm learning what you're doing, but I've learned pattern disruption on the spot because I can cause mayhem.
Yes. So taking that back to you and then what you then wrote for everyone else, because it's kind of when we go on these journeys, and often as healers, you know, we heal through pain. So, you know, we heal through our own wounds because it's the most authentic way to help people. So you've been, you were yo-yo dieting, and then you somehow or other worked out that this energy of shame was kind of what was triggering what was going on, and then realised that it wasn't just you. Can we just
absolutely
dig into that? Mm. Let's unbox that, because that's what's going to be so helpful for, I think, people listening to this, because it's not just about weight loss. This episode is not just about weight. This is about any kind of addictive behaviour, and we all have it. I mean, you literally came in saying, I haven't had a coffee in 5 days.
Yeah.
And that's, we were just talking about that this morning as well, because I put up my self-care schedule every day on my stories because it's a good way to show everyone how I fit it all in. Because, well, this is what I'm doing today and this is how I fit it all in. And I put mushroom coffee every morning, because every mid-morning I have a mushroom coffee. There's no coffee in it. It's just mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
But now I have to take it with me, because I was at a hotel I was at Babington actually this weekend. And yeah, it's a really nice hotel and they do very good coffee. But I took my mushroom powder with me because I can't drink coffee anymore. So easy peasy. But we've all just suddenly announced this shift. So the shame, let's go into that, please.
Yes. Well, on the addiction point, I will say too that 10 years ago, when I piloted what became a workshop that became a book called The Kindness Method, my first book, which drew from everything I saw working in addiction treatment, but just took out the drug words and turned them into, like, you know, generic everyday words.
Yeah.
Even at that time, when I would say to people, who thinks they have an addictive personality?
Everyone's like, yes, me.
10 years. And now they're, I think, scrolling, ultra-processed food, all of it. And so what's happened now is that the people who are in the addiction vulnerable demographic, or, you know, the population of addiction vulnerable people is increasing. That's because if you worked a program, you were an addict.
Right.
Now, if you don't have a program, you will become an addict. Mm. I mean, it's your habits are choosing you at this stage. Like, when you get, all that we do all day is engage in habits. And I was telling someone, you know, if proficiency is gained through repetition, if proficiency is gained through repetition, then the longer you don't change for, the better you're getting at the habits you want to change, you know? And so this is what I learned when I was working in the prisons, and I was working first when I was working in the community in Northwest London. I started assessing people, and I realized the way that they were speaking to me about their problems with drugs was exactly the same way that I was speaking to myself about my problems with food. Why can't I stop? I don't want to do this anymore. I feel powerless. I feel possessed. And I realized, A, that the tools that we were helping with these people to use were free.
Mm.
And at the time, I was paying a lot of money trying to sort myself out.
Yeah. And the only pounds we lose on these diets are... all the gizmos that they're trying to sell.
Quite. And they leave us with, you know, a cost. And I notice that these people are doing, they're managing to do something in a row until it feels easier.
Right.
That's what behavioural change is, right? So it's all behavioural change. When you learn how to use an app, you're doing behavioural change. We only think that it's a habit as opposed to just something we've learned when it becomes a problem, really, and we can't change it. And usually what I've noticed is that shame is what takes skill building into... it makes it personal. So if I said to you right now, if you had no history of issues with food after you'd had your children and someone had said, hey, just do Weight Watchers, you might have been all right. Because there's no like, oh, this is like every other time, then I didn't do it. Or this isn't going to get easier, I remember this bit. Or,
oh my God, you're even saying that literally. It's really interesting how when someone comes in with truth and kindness, because you talk about kindness as your currency as well. So we've got shame and kindness kind of all orbiting. And that sort of sympathy vote of course you felt like this because blah, blah, blah. And if it was normalized like this, you would have felt like that. And I can feel my soul just kind of, even though I've sorted it all out now and I'm all okay, just the memory of what it felt like at the time, endlessly looking at myself in photographs going, oh, just not wanting, I've got no baby photos with me in them because I just felt so ashamed of how I looked and I hated it so much. It's so sad.
It's also really unhelpful. Aside from anything else, it doesn't work. That's the shame of it, if you will. I mean, there's greater shames, of course, but the shame of it then is it also just backfires because the more shame you have, the more when you're hungry, what are you going to comfort yourself with? The thing you've been restricting yourself from that works, that doesn't hurt anyone else but you, sugar, you know. And I think that in the case of us, when you feel that you are wrong, if it starts too early and the shame is in there, you don't know why you're being given less food. You don't know why you're being restricted. You don't know why people don't, I don't know, I was going to say fancy you, but that doesn't happen until later, thank God. But do you see what I mean? Like, you don't know why the world is doing this to you. You have to be told. And then you're told, by the way, this is a result of your choices, which it technically is. Now, how powerless you feel over your choices compared to another person and how you came to be that way is a different
story. And how you came to choose that in the first
place.
Yeah.
And also the fact that much like a drug addict, women feel very patronized. I know the issue is there for men too, but it's largely women who have been given this level of pressure. If you feel patronized, because imagine all of those things you were managing to do. You've had children. Everything you've been through, the work you've done, the people you've helped, the businesses you've created, the relation, everything, the broadcasting, all of it. And then at the end of the day, you're still saying to yourself, well, can't control myself around a cake though. It negates, because it's objectively simple. Don't eat it.
Yeah.
It's obvious on you, which is really unfair. And it's something that you know you can technically do, and you're not doing it. And you know you want it more than anything.
And yet you can't do it. So you
can't do it. So you can't even internalize the other objectively wonderful accomplishments that you have, because this very, very simple thing is eluding you. And so that's where the shame comes in, and that's where the conversation comes in. So to come back to if you didn't have sort of priors with it, imagine if I said to you now, like, do you know how to do upholstery?
No.
Okay, cool.
So if I
said we're going to go to an upholstery class, and I, tomorrow, and we're going to do it for 12 weeks, and I might be a little bit better than you might be a little bit better than me, but I don't think we would stop going because we weren't good at it.
No.
Or it wasn't easy yet.
Or we were embarrassed about the fact we couldn't do it.
No, I've never been able to do it before.
Yeah.
And we've never been able to, at that time, moderate how we eat before. So the idea that we'd be embarrassed isn't about how we behave. It's about how we look. And so to change how you behave in order to change how you look, aside from the judgment and the stigma and the shame, it's also just it's not helpful for behavioral change. Because when you want to change a behavior, particularly if you're addiction vulnerable, which people tend to be if they end up in the position where they feel powerless around food, right? You kind of want to get your win then.
Yeah.
Not go, okay, maybe if I don't eat this and I white knuckle it, and maybe if I have some extra green tea, and then maybe if I'll just skip a meal, then I'll just close my eyes and I'll look down at the scales, and then brilliant. And that will dictate how, I mean, this is not even a
I wouldn't change any behaviour this way. That's like saying, one day I'll learn a little bit French, one day I'll do a little bit Duolingo, one day I'll watch a French programme, by the end of the week, hopefully I go to Paris and speak French.
Oh, you see what a mess it is. It's such... So,
stuff has got nothing to do with it.
I love it, because you are really articulating the conflicting narrative, which doesn't even complete its own sentences, because it's so... It's so complex, and it's been so entrenched, and especially to this audience, which is that sort of late 20th century, born in the 70s, 80s type audience, who have had all these messages, most of which were wrong, you know, the whole calories in, calories out, all of it, which is sort of dispersing now. So, okay, take a deep breath.
I know, but then, I didn't want to interrupt you quickly.
No.
Calories in and out is wrong?
Yeah.
Doesn't it, in the end,
there is, okay,
the land mammals come down?
Okay, like, there's a little bit of that. There is calories in, calories out. Obviously, if you just sit here eating Pringles, watching telly all day, not moving, it's not going to do you any good. But it's not just a question of creating a calorie deficit and that's it.
Totally.
Which in the 1980s, that's what it was. Cut calories, move more, eat less. That was the formula. There was none of that knowledge about which foods agree with, and this all came in later. Say, for example, foods that work with your blood, or eating seasonal foods, or eating foods that are actually responsive to your own particular situation. One of the things that I do is I read Chinese astrology, and Chinese astrology will give you the footprint of how your body is and where your own personal strengths and weaknesses are, which even goes beyond blood. Okay, so when you can do a blood test, eat right for your blood type, I'm like, yes, there is a lot in that, and there is, and there's inflammatory foods and eating the right foods for you and all the rest of it. But actually, how your energy is positioned impacts the kind of foods you should be eating. For sure. I mean, I am living proof of this, and how your lifestyle creates inflammation in the body and what your body then chooses to do with that inflammation. So my body puts inflammation in fat cells. That's because that's the way that my body is composed because of my energy flow. Okay. Whereas, e.g., my son, who is skinny and can eat anything he likes, but it comes out through his skin. I've never had spots in my life. Whereas he is like, he can end up down acne if we're not careful, but we deal with him in a different way. So the thing is, there's so much detail within that. Obviously, if you think of it like a pyramid, so calories in, calories out is like the baseline. It's like, mm-hmm. obviously you've got to kind of keep what you're doing versus what you're consuming in some kind of balancing act. There is, but then there's blood, and then there's energy. And we're not even at the energy bit. Probably the energy diet is something I need to write. Actually, I need to do that. But anyway,
yeah,
we need
please.
To do that.
Right. Could you do that,
okay.
please?
But the information available to us now in the first, just we're now in the second quarter of the 21st century, is far more sophisticated than what we were getting in the 80s.
Well, this is it. And I think this is what I mean in terms of you being much more a health practitioner in that sense. Because, for example, the calories in and out thing has ended up being, yes, it's sort of primitive and clunky in terms of what we know now, and also
it's a baseline,
from a Western perspective. But the fact that it's even become a baseline, I think, is really important, because it has become an important conversation. Because with things like GLP-1s, I want to say to the diet industry, I want everyone to go,
just
hey,
tell
look,
what the GLP-1
sorry,
is.
Like Ozempic, Wegovy, but the injections people are giving themselves
the
to not to have less of to crave less and lose weight ultimately, or to manage diabetes, and I feel that we are, to some degree, I mean, it's the faintest of silver linings, but somewhat vindicated, because it's like, look, in the end, people right now, many of them are using those things healthily, but large proportion of them, much like I would, are just eating a little bit of crap because that'll keep them thin. And that it doesn't, being slim doesn't teach you how to eat and cook and shop. And, you know, so I think we just assume that because, of course, some people are so superior that they'll just become chefs, and so it's absolutely absurd. And so I do feel vindicated in being able to say, look guys, all that stuff they sold us, in the end it really was calories in and out. And the reason I want to say that is because I don't want people to now go, oh yeah, it was my choice, and it really was just calories in and out in that sense. I want to say, look, it really was, and they gaslit you to the point where now you have to pay them again to control yourself.
Yeah.
But
like
yes.
Cambridge diet, all things like that.
This is it. And I think that a lot of the time, despite the fact I'm very privileged in countless ways, and I'm very lucky to be speaking to people like yourself who are so educated in this. But, you know, I would be your client at this stage in the process. That's where I would be, like getting back in touch with stuff. And
Many of the people I speak to are so, so, so behind in that sense, because shame is, you know, makes people quiet. And so they haven't even shared with themselves the extent of it. It's like when you ask someone to write down, like, I don't ask people to do this, but if you ask someone to write down what they've eaten, it's like asking someone to write, someone has just told you that they only have two or three glasses of wine, to write down how much they've been drinking, and they realize that's not the reality.
Or cigarettes, yeah, or any of these
things. Sorry, so I know I digress. So yes, I must, you asked me a question about how I came to know these things. I learned what was helping addicts to stop taking drugs and including alcohol. And I learned what was working. And one thing that was working was not shaming people.
Right.
Because whilst things like the 12-step programs are fear-based.
Are they?
Yeah, well, it's essentially like there's a lot of sharing that goes into, like, if you don't come, you will die, for example. Thank you so much. But in a gratitude sense, like, I'm so grateful to be here. Had I not found the fellowship, I wouldn't be here.
I mean, I'm not an expert on that, actually, but it just, for my uneducated eye, I'm looking at it going, it leverages community and accountability.
Wonderful.
And that is helpful, because this is a community. And one of the things that I know is that people often say it's so good to share, but you should only share because you want to share, I would say.
Yeah,
but anyway, I digress. I'm digressing again. Back to you. So what you're saying is the techniques that you were using for addicts, you suddenly realised actually, well, because of course these... alcohol and food, I mean, they're literally food and beverage is within the same category. So you can see the one short leap for mankind that needed to be made here.
But also, yes, alcohol, one can be sober from it. But also, we don't have much of a provision for people to become moderate drinkers either. It is still either dry January or this like remedial thing. And it's like, guys, we're all normalizing taking a highly addictive drug for the rest of our lives. Like, if you want to drink for the rest of your life, you're probably going to need some plan at some point to not feel dependent just because of the tolerance. Like during COVID, I spoke to loads of people who developed once you open the second bottle. I can't tell you how many people were like, once you open the second bottle, like, it's a slippery slope. It takes a while to go from a couple of glasses to a bottle, I understand. I'm more into spirits, by the way. This isn't because I'm so high and mighty that I don't know about wine. I'm just more into spirits. But if I've heard a lot of people who are really into wine during COVID, especially, saying like, well, look, the journey from two glasses to a bottle, especially if it's red wine, is longer than the journey of one bottle to two bottles. Because the second bottle's open. And obviously your mind is altered. You've just drank a bottle of wine.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So obviously more is more at that stage. And so more and more I was kind of thinking, how would I adapt these if you couldn't be abstinent? What if like two was a relapse for me, not one? And I started using these things on myself. I started going to the same support groups that I was doing for people. And of course I was learning. My job then became to consult to NHS, Ministry of Justice, become a trainer in how to actually help addicts to self-manage behaviors. And during that period of time, I also went and piloted a workshop at the School of Life. And I said, I can do a resolutions workshop for you. And I won't tell anyone that I'm from drug treatment background. Charge normal, bougie, you know, prices. And I will promise them that by the end of this, they can change any habit they want. They don't even have to tell me, and no one has to say a word. And because I knew that these were so robust, because they had been tested out in the most challenging. These are people who had, these tools were working on people who had generations of addiction before them, who were homeless often. Wow. And they're doing these maps, you know, whilst homeless. Wow. With social services involvement. I mean, this was real change resistance. And so I almost learned at the hardest end of it. And the extraordinary reality to me was that my relationship with food, I had way more in common with people in Narcotics Anonymous than I did in Weight Watchers. I had a food problem that manifested itself on my body in a society that didn't like how that looked. I did not have a how I looked problem that I wasn't managing to sort out. And that was the issue.
There's the difference.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the issue. And I realized that these people are not trying to become someone who looks like they're in recovery. They're trying to feel empowered not to drink today. And recovery will take care of itself. I need to feel empowered not to make choices with food that I regret. And weight loss will take care of itself.
Oh, my God, that's such a brilliant giant quantum leap forward. So from that realization,
I lost 8 stone,
and which is incredible. And you look amazing, although you would have looked amazing anyway.
It fluctuates, but yeah, I feel good.
So what were the techniques therefore that you used to actually sort of to carry that out? So there's the mental shift. There's the sort of the paradigm shift. Okay, there it is. So then what did you do to actually sort of bring that in?
The great thing is now looking back in 10 years, I can actually tell you from a different lens what I was doing than
yes,
how I was describing
yes,
it at the time.
Of hindsight.
Exactly. So what I was doing was essentially giving people the script to speak to themselves in a way that would get them to the next choice until their behaviors became automated.
And how's that?
By speaking to themselves the way they would a friend. And that doesn't mean letting, you know, you're lovely, you're amazing, this is going to be easy, but actually being really reasonable. Like, of course you can do this. You've done harder things than this. Mm. This will pass. It's extraordinary how when it gets personal, the same way we would with the upholstery class, right? If you were like, Shaz, oh, I'm not very good at upholstery, I'd be like, don't worry about it. Like, we'll just go back, you know? That kind of hold it lightly mentality, which applies to behavioral change, that's what works. And the other thing that works is not focusing on what's wrong, because the person who you're trying to decrease the shame of in order to activate behavior and believe and feel worthy of change and all of those things, bear in mind who's, in my case, has a string of legitimately shameful stuff. You know, people have done some objectively bad stuff, you know, that is going to come back. And now you don't have your drug to distract from and all of this stuff. Being able to tell that person, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility. And the behaviors that are so bad, don't worry about why they're bad. You know why. No one knows better than you do why they're bad.
Mm.
Anyone who's tried to change a behavior for ages and it plagues them cannot stand it when somebody says, like, oh, you know, it's not very nice to be. So it's not very good for you to look that way. And it's like, are you high? I know. That's all I think about every day, all day.
Mm.
Of course I know. It's much more compelling to tell people, as an intelligent, wise, capable person, any behavior you engage in that you find it hard to stop engaging in must be doing something profoundly important for you or must have done something profoundly important for you and now has just been automated. Is automated the right word? Yeah. So that's what I was trying to bring it back to common sense, because compassion, self-love, these are big leaps. One needs to be in already a pretty good place to even entertain these concepts.
Yeah.
Or replace, I hate myself, I'm worthless with, but I'm a goddess. No.
Oh, it's too much of a leap.
It's too much of a leap.
Oh, that's so true. This is what I say about meditation. So that, you know, people who sit there in clinic saying to me, I've tried meditation and I can't do it. And they look at you and you think, well, of course, because you're asking somebody from a very, very frenzied life, because that is our lives now, with a few notable exceptions. But for by and large, most of us are just like trying to keep all the plates spinning. And then suddenly you're expected to just relax. And so that's why I teach them to go first into a fidget energy, because it matches your vibration. So that if you're going like this energetically, then actually you need the body to fidget first, and then you go to a sway, and then eventually you sit still, and then you stop meditating. And it's a little process. It's just a little transition. And what you're describing here is the same thing. You can't ask anybody that goes from the history of why they're doing what they're doing to either just pull yourself together and just stop eating it, or just resist it, or just don't be so ridiculous. Just stop eating it. Don't have it in the house. Just don't do it then. Don't eat anything at 9 o'clock. Don't do that. Don't have cake.
Doesn't that make you want it more?
Of course it does. Because it doesn't address the underlying issue as to why you needed it in the first place. And so if you go into that space, which is where you've gone into that liminal space between A and B and gone, right, let's just unbox this little bit here and really evaluate it. So let's go into the tenderness. And actually, you talk also about kindness. Mm-hmm. So you're treating it with kindness. So that's what you're saying. You're just being nice to yourself about it and going, okay, give me a break here.
Unkindness is, kindness definitely, definitely important. And I have to say, you know, the kindness piece, I'm working on, like, so many of my clients are so much further ahead than I am. We all have different baselines, right?
Mm.
In terms of the being able to soften up the way we speak to ourselves, because I unfortunately have internalized some pretty extreme core beliefs that some
about yourself.
Haven't. Yeah, that you hear the same way I imagine you will have had. Some people have a stronger current to swim against because of how long it's been going on or what they came into before they had choices.
How they were programmed by their DNA or even past lives, if you believe in that.
We're not all starting from the same place, but the kindness piece is it's I always find it easier when people are starting from a real deficit of kindness to say unkindness is not smart.
Mm.
Like, it's not, and it doesn't have, there's no common sense in it. So for example, if I came to you and said, I'm really struggling to do something and I've made a little bit of progress and I've just had a bit of a blip, so obviously I'm just going to set this whole thing on fire, it isn't worth it, et cetera, et cetera. The kind thing to say wouldn't be, oh yeah, just sack it off. Just like when you were 10 years old, you always start things and don't finish them.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not kind, but it also doesn't get you to get back on track.
Mm.
Like, from a practical perspective. Whereas if you were, yes, if you said, you are amazing, you're extraordinary, let me give you everything, you deserve the world, I believe that would work far better.
Mm.
But failing that, you could just say, this was never going to, there were always going to be blips for you. You would have done it by now.
Mm.
Right, so like, just like everything else hard you've done. So I think sometimes, and again, this is something that I've learned over the years because people have given me feedback and been kind enough to tell me that some people are on the sharp end of even the word kind is not.
It's too much.
Too much. And so it makes me want to cry. But they say things like, but then what I've done is help them to go like, right, well, then how about we say, don't be unkind. And what that does is help them to realize the distinction between what, you know, a lot of people that pride themselves on being smart.
Mm.
You know, it's easier to hang on to I'm a smart person than I'm a worthy person,
mm.
I think, mm. because it's still about the doing and not about the being. And I think that the messages we get really early on is, if it starts too early and eating and how we look and therefore the quality of life that we'll have, not from a health perspective, but from an acceptance and shame perspective is linked, we start to think not something is wrong with this. We think something is wrong with me.
Hmm.
And that is a very blanket and pervasive and horrible, horrible thing to believe.
Hmm.
So what I came to understand is that to make that distinction for people on the ground, in the community, etc., and for myself was transformative. And in order to just change a habit, just stay on track with your plan, mm. it was just more compelling to say, you've got this, this was always going to be hard, let's just keep going, than it is to say, yeah, sack it off, and actually you can't start things until Monday anyway.
Mm.
Because most people take pride in giving good advice. And so what I did was kind of help them close, as I did for myself and as I did for my clients at the time, just help people close the gap between the choice they would, when they're challenged and they feel like they don't know what the next best choice is, or the perfect choice isn't available, mm. that was on the plan. Often people like myself, when the best choice isn't available, we make the worst one, not the second best.
Mm.
And so I helped them to just have a bit of a hook that was kind of like, the kind choice is defined as the choice I would tell the person I love the most to make right now,
mm.
the choice I would make if someone I really respected was watching me, the choice I'll be most proud to have made tomorrow. And it's an acknowledgement of the fact that different versions of you will show up throughout the day.
Mm.
And so again, I look at that from a behavioral change perspective, but I assume that you would look at that as your nervous system will be activated to different degrees throughout the day,
yeah.
and therefore will be reaching more urgently, or more impulsively, or more damagingly,
yeah.
for things. And so I started putting that into processes. The School of Life workshop did really well. I became a faculty member there, and I started just kind of being known for, she's not going to judge you.
It's so interesting, because I think from a Chinese perspective, we approach things from a different angle, but we end up in a very similar space. And one of the things that I always talk to people about when they're talking to me about, specifically because weight loss comes up a lot in clinic, because often people, when they get sort of postmenopause or perimenopause, they struggle and it sort of becomes upsetting because they're not getting the results they want. And then in comes this negative narrative, as I call it. And one of the things which I always advise, which sounds so similar to what you're saying, is because this negative narrative and this shame can make things feel so much worse and so much heavier and so much harder. And then you feel like a failure mm. if you don't achieve the goal that you've set up in the first place. And how come I can't do it when other people can? And in it all comes is we do something really, which is just habit stacking and general lifestyle shifting, so that you start to focus on small little incremental changes, which bit by bit will just become the daily norm. And root you into a routine, which ultimately supports. So the spleen energy, as I said, is the digestive energy. So the spleen is very much the nurturing organ of the body, and it's what needs feeding when it's deficient. So when it's getting overwhelmed or off whack or spiraling out of control, or just really just can't cope with everything that's being hurled at it every day, which is, you were talking about, so many people now addicted to all sorts of things, which in back in the 80s, we didn't do the scrolling, we didn't have it. And life was slower then than it is now. So I find so many women, especially women and men, but mainly women, coming into clinic with the same kind of underpinning symptoms, where they just feel that they can't control everything. And then in comes the food and it's another thing they can't control. So we bring the kindness in by using gentle techniques to give you nurture and warmth and support coming in other ways. So it's not just the food that is the way that does it. Because otherwise, if you don't do these other things, food becomes the resort, because it's like the wine you were talking about. The wine is the quick route to switching it all off and just going, I'm relaxing right now, I'm having a glass of wine. It's the fast track. It's the speedy boarding.
It's the solution. It's not the problem.
Yeah, it is. And the problem is the speed of life and what's going on right now, and the fact that we've all got to somehow cope with a pace that we're not designed to go at and has become normalised by modern day culture. I mean, even the speed at which we travel I'm not saying the old days were good, in many ways they were not, but in terms of the body, there's lots of things that were good, like walking pace is a pace that the body understands because it's going at walking pace, which is how human beings used to move. Then we'd go to horse pace, but you wouldn't go faster than sort of 25 miles an hour on even the fastest of horses. So now we're in cars and trains and aeroplanes. So we're going at a massive pace. Even if you're just driving, anyone that's driven a car and has gone off the motorway to a side road, how hard it is to come down. I did a speed awareness course. This is true, actually. I did a speed awareness course. Right. They taught me this. And it was like, it's really hard to slow down because you've been going at, say, 60, 70 miles an hour on the motorway. And then suddenly you're in a 40 mile zone. It feels really slow and it's really annoying. It's like, oh, I want to keep going. And the body does the same thing because it's speeding past. I mean, tech is much quicker than us. So everything speeds us up. That, in turn, disrupts the spleen, which is the organ, primarily the digestive system, disrupts the liver. The liver opens to our eyes. The liver is anger, frustration, resentment, and judgment. And it also has a massive responsibility to the digestive system. And often what then happens is, if we're starving ourselves or rushing around like headless chickens, barely able to eat all day because we simply don't have time, skipping meals and moving meals and not eating regularly, not having our meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the same time each day, or going to bed late and eating into the liver energy time at night, we're not asleep, restoring, we're awake, scrolling, or doing our last bits of work, it affects the digestive system. In come the cravings, in come the, I can't resist, I have to have cake in the afternoon, I have to eat at 9 o'clock at night, because it's the organs responding to this crazy life, going, I need. So in comes a glass of wine, or in comes a cake, or in come the cheese and biscuits, or in comes the overeating, because the triggers are just so overwhelming. And we come in with a really soft, kind, gentle habit stack of going, okay, we know what the problem is. It's bonkers out there. Okay, it is. There's no question about it. So what we've got to do is just, we've got to create the balance in here, despite the fact that there's a world of crazy going on out there. Like, that's going to carry on. This is what we're going to focus on. So we're going to do some breathing techniques. We're going to do some divine dialogue as opposed to negative narrative. And you said it's really hard for somebody full of self-loathing, and I've been there too, to go, I love myself, I feel great. In comes an affirmation. I love myself. I am worthy. I am a fantastic person. I can't say that when I feel dreadful. So we go in with a soft step forwards, which is just, let's just focus on feeling less bad.
Yeah.
Let's transition gently.
Beautifully put.
Sheree, you are just amazing. And thank you for your story, your journey, your books. These are all best-selling books, by the way. I highly recommend them. And I'm looking forward to having you on the sofa again soon.
Thank you. I would love to. It's an absolute pleasure. Really. Thank you so much.
Thank you.